Today I'm here with Nolan Bushnell, who is one of the pioneers of the computer industry for a lot of us. He founded Atari and then went on to found Chuck E. Cheese. He's also founded something like 20 other different companies, I guess a lot of which have failed, but he's had some pretty big successes, and it's a real honor to have you here. So, Nolan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'd like to add only six of them failed, and they were the small ones.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we can maybe talk about those. So do you want to just tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and sort of how things got started for you?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Utah. I was a Mormon boy right on the Wasatch Front there, about halfway between Salt Lake and Ogden. Sort of bounded on one side by mountains and a big Air Force base, and the Great Salt Lake, which was really nasty at the time. I mean, it was salty and quite unpleasant, actually.
And so how did you, where did you go from there?
I graduated in electrical engineering, moved to California, to really the heart of Silicon Valley, took a job with a company called Ampex in high-density digital recording and video.
I haven't been out in the valley for a little while, but the last time I was there, I think there was still the Ampex sign on 101.
Yeah, that's sort of a historical monument. Even though none of the buildings are Ampex, Ampex kind of got sold off and dismembered in the 80s. But it was one of the big movers and shakers in the valley in the 60s and 70s.
And how long did you work at Ampex for?
Pardon?
How long did you work at Ampex for?
Just 2 years.
All right. And then, so what happened then?
Basically, invented what the kind of core technology of the video game business. Licensed that to a company called Nutting Associates. Went to work for them for a year. And then decided to hang out my own shingle, my partner and I, a guy named Ted Dabney, and we started Atari, and our first employee, Al Alcorn, as a training project, invented Pong, and we were off to the races.
Now, what drew you to California then? I remember, and so why this interview is interesting, very interesting for me, is because I grew up on the Commodore 64 and then the Amiga, and so I spent 90% of my childhood on those sorts of things. But, you know, Atari was very much there as well. I remember as I was growing up seeing a lot of this coincidence kept happening over and over, that there was all of these companies in California that were important, like Epix and Atari and Commodore and all of these others, and I sort of started to realize that they were all around San Francisco, but this was before we'd really heard of anything like Silicon Valley. And you went out to California in the 60s, so what was it that drew you out there at that time?
Well, there were two or three reasons. First of all, I thought that semiconductors were going to be important, and it was really where all the silicon the semiconductors were being created. I mean, everybody was there with the exception of Texas Instruments, and even they had a pretty good facility there. And so if you had Intel, National Semiconductor, AMD, they were all basically, you could throw a rock from each of those to the other to the other buildings that were really the center of gravity of the silicon research, and I just thought that was going to be big, and there were several, and I went down and interviewed there. It may have been serendipity. My wife's sister lived in Saratoga, California, which is sort of on the edge of Silicon Valley, and it was easy for us to go and stay with her while I was doing some interviewing, looking for a job.
Huh. Because that down there, it was all orchard trees then, wasn't it?
It was. Prune trees.
I mean, it wasn't the of the of that era, wasn't that, I mean, we see in the movie The Graduate, wasn't plastics the thing?
Not there. It was definitely silicon.
So it was very clear back then that silicon was going to be very important.
Not to everybody. But I was an electrical engineer, I think a lot of people don't realize the drastic change, because literally when I started college, we were learning about vacuum tubes, and when I ended college, we were learning about silicon, and semiconductors were such a superior technology to vacuum tubes. I mean, it was more than an order of magnitude in improvement in price, performance, overhead, you know, weight, battery consumption. Everything was better. Like, everything was better with silicon over vacuum tubes. And so you just didn't want to go, and you just didn't want to build things with vacuum tubes anymore. And that had been the predominant technology, you know, basically during the previous century.
So you strike out on your own with your partner Ted. You didn't create the game Pong. You made it first available on home consoles, right? It had been a game before that, right?
Yeah, we played it in college on the big computers. Actually, I think the very first ping pong game, the very very first one that anybody knows of is by a guy named Willie Higginbotham, who did a ping pong game in New York in 1958.
And so you did that, and then what happened next? I'd love to hear the beginning story of Atari. This is kind of astounding.
Well, we got the original prototype going, and at the time we had a contract, a work for hire contract, and that was our plan. When we started at Atari, our plan was to design games and license them to others. We didn't perceive ourselves as having either the capital nor the expertise to go into manufacturing ourselves. I mean, it just seemed like a daunting task. And then we had this game, and it was pretty fun. And we thought, well, hey, maybe our contractor will accept this instead of the driving game. We basically contracted to do a driving game for them. Uh-huh. And so we did that, went to them. They were unimpressed. For reasons that were real, but in the end turns out to be unimportant. And that was that up till then, any coin-operated game, video or otherwise, always had a single-player mode. And because a lot of people were in arcades and that, and they would run around by themselves, and so to have it only be a single player or a two player game was perceived to be a marketing flaw. Huh. And so they turned it down, and then I was disappointed, but the second unit, while I was, you know, the company was Bally, and they were in Chicago. I'd climbed on an airplane to go to Chicago, and it was the other game was put into a bar and tested. In fact, it went in just before I left, and the first collections came in while I was in Chicago, and that was when the there's kind of a famous story that has been told and told and told that we got a service call that the game had broken, but the only thing that happened is the coin box had totally filled up so that it couldn't take any more money.
Oh, really?
And that was a kind of a fault that we felt we were more than capable of remedying.
And so things took off. I was reading a little bit about, just to understand the business history, because I haven't understood this side at all. But I guess things took off, but you would have liked to have been able to go to something like an IPO, but there was not a strong market at that time.
That's correct.
And so what did you do then?
Well, I mean, what you're talking about there was, you know, 2 or 3 years in. We basically funded the company by bootstrapping. We had no investor until we got a couple of million of VC money 3-4 years after that. Huh. And it was, everybody thought that video games were silly. How could they possibly be an important business?
yeah.
And, you know, it was just, you know, they wanted something more important, like wheat or maybe wool.
And so you were then, I mean, so I was then on the receiving end of some of this in Australia. Now, I was using the Commodore 64 and not Atari so much, but certainly some of my friends were. How was this, from your perspective, operating? Like, I mean, I'm in Tasmania, Australia, as a 12-year-old. How are you getting your work over to my friends in Australia? How does all that work?
Well, one day we were being quite successful in terms of selling Pong machines. We were up to manufacture, and these were coin operated, and in the coin operated game business. Is pretty worldwide, just by its nature. But I hadn't sold internationally. In fact, I don't even think I had a passport. and so a guy came and said, hey, he wanted to represent me internationally. And that, you know, all we had to do is give him a percentage, and that he'd, you know, pay for all his expenses, and that was that. We did that, and he basically blanketed the world with distributors for us.
Huh.
And it was really interesting, because probably a year later, half our revenue was derived from foreign markets.
Huh. And that was something you didn't have the expertise to do at all.
No, I didn't know it. But, you know, to give this guy the opportunity to do it and give him a nice commission, and it didn't cost me anything. And, you know, it was a really, turned out to be a very good business move for me.
And it probably was for him as well.
Oh, extraordinarily good.
Hmm. So he would have then gotten on the phone and gone and visiting people all over the world to set up all these distribution deals for you.
Correct. And I basically went with him on a couple of these calls, and just to meet and greet and shake hands with the people that he'd selected to represent Atari worldwide.
How big were you in terms of sales at that point?
Probably 20 million.
Hmm. But you were pretty famous. But what year are we talking about by then?
74.
74.
Yeah.
Okay, so you weren't very famous back then.
Not too. I mean, in the Valley, I was starting to get a reputation there.
Hmm. And so things then grew?
Grew rapidly.
And so then what happened?
Alcorn discovered this really new technology called N-channel for custom chips, and he felt that finally there was a way to put our technology into a consumer product. The prices were right, the speed and the performance were right, and so we embarked on that.
Why bother doing that when you're already doing well with consoles as they were? I mean, wouldn't it have been better just to focus on the console market on its own, or did you get more growth? Is that where you needed to go?
Oh, I just felt that there's this old thing that Andy Grove did, and he always said only the paranoid survive. And I always felt that you always had to be aware of sources of potential competition. And I felt that if there was a consumer game possible, then somebody would do it. And from getting strength with that, they may be able to come back and attack us in the coin op.
Right.
So I always felt that strategically you had to take advantage of opportunities for growth. And the coin-operated game business is maybe a $300 million business in terms of consoles.
That was back then?
Yeah, and it's bigger if you count coin drop, but in terms of the number of machines that are sold annually, it was about $200 million.
Right.
Which was a lot of money in those days, but I could definitely see that we were approaching headroom.
Right, okay. So then you go and start making... What was your first Atari machine that you made for the home market?
Pong again.
Right.
And then we did a couple of more. But these were like custom games in which you buy the game for $60 and that's all it would play.
Right.
We had games called... Atari Pinball and Stunt Cycle, and then we felt that we could do it in which the different games were on a software cartridge.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that turned out to be the 2600.
Right. And that was your big slam dunk, wasn't it?
It was.
And so before we got on here, you were asking about distribution of other consoles in Australia and whether we had the Spectrum and the... So we had the TRS-80 and the BBC. And I can tell you from school, we got taught the BBCs we got a lot of access to. Friends of mine tended to have a lot... The Commodores were pretty popular, Commodore 64. And then there was quite a few Ataris and then quite a few Apples. And I guess I couldn't really pick that easily between those three.
Well, that's because they were basically all... Well, the Commodore, the Apple, and the Atari were all based on the 6502,
right,
which is a family of microprocessors. And that was also the microprocessor that ran the 2600.
Right.
Because of the massive volumes that the 2600 generated, it made that processor very, very cheap in comparison to the others. As I remember, I think the BBC Buggy was based on the 8080. Do you remember?
I didn't use BBCs that much. We'd use them when we had to for school, and then that would be about it.
Yeah. Yeah, and it... The Z80, yeah, I think I'm pretty sure there was the Z80 that was the ran that. I'll have to look that up. I somehow it's gotten foggy. But anyway,
the BBC. I mean, they moved on to, wasn't it the Archimedes was their new version? Maybe I'm confusing things.
But I'm thinking of the underlying architecture. Which microprocessor was? I think it was the Z80.
Yeah, I might be a generation in front on that. I'm not sure. It is a very long time ago.
Yeah, it is. And it probably doesn't matter to your listeners.
Well, I certainly, I mean, 6502, I mean, I cut my teeth writing 6502. two code. I mean, you know, there was a lot of games we wanted, and so that was how we had to get them sometimes.
Exactly. Exactly. That was the way it was. And, God, I even remember back when we were playing around and with punch with paper tape and audio tape, you know, just a little audio receiver.
Those were great. And then, you know, we upgraded to a disk drive that it would only take 15 minutes to load a game, and that was a revolution.
Yeah.
You were dealing with all of us, you know, 11-year-olds who were copying all your games. What was what was your viewpoint on that sort of stuff at that time?
I thought it was kind of cool. I mean, we were making so much money to have kids, you know, copying games onto audio tapes. I thought it was kind of cool, actually.
That's funny. I mean, it was, you know, it because we had to be really smart, so it taught us a hell of a lot of stuff.
Exactly. And that's the way I looked at it. I felt that all this was sort of laying the educational foundation for the business that I knew was going to happen. You know, I just knew that the computer was going to be a massive part of everyday life. And you guys were really on the vanguard.
Yeah. That was amazing. I mean, it consumed every single second of our time. you know, we were really into it. I'm curious. So you were going head-to-head back then with Steve Jobs and Jack Tramiel, weren't you?
That's correct.
What was Jack Tramiel like?
Very difficult man. He probably embodied the concept that war, or that the business is war, and that war is hell. He was a real no, take no prisoners kind of guy. He actually played pretty dirty.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't like to say bad things about people, but he was not a nice man.
Well, I mean, he's passed away a couple of years ago now. If there's any stories you want to tell, it might be interesting to hear them.
Oh, I think somebody else should tell those.
Okay.
I'd just rather stay above the fray, but...
I mean, we certainly... The Commodore 64 was a fantastic computer. He really got
that
right.
Oh, yeah. And it was cheap, and there were a lot of things, but... He did several things, like he would use parts from a particular manufacturer, mm-hmm. and put some great big orders in, and they thought that they were having a good... Then he wouldn't pay them. And in a couple of cases, because of his receivable, he would then come in, and as they were... choking on his unpaid bill, offered to buy them at a huge discount, and they were left with almost no option. Huh. I think that's dirty.
That's I guess that helped keep the cost down and made it easier for all of us to buy them.
I guess.
But yeah. And so you also had the chance to buy 30% of Apple for $50,000.
That's correct.
Which you wisely chose not to accept.
Yeah, boy, that was prescient.
Have you had any more ones that have stung as much as that, or is that the biggest one?
I could have got in very, very early in a big way with Cisco.
All right.
But it was, you know, down in the unitary percentages. I think I had an opportunity to own, for a relatively small amount of money, like 6% of Cisco, six or eight.
Right.
And I had some. I think I ended up investing in a VC firm that did, Don Valentine's firm.
All right.
And I think I ended up with 1%, and I sold it way early.
Right.
but it was a very good investment.
I guess the bigger thing is, though, that you were there at the very dawn of the computer age, and I mean, in theory, the Atari could have become the Mac or the PC, and I guess that was the thing. Like, what would the path to of reaching that look like, do you think?
Well, I think that Apple and Atari, Apple was ahead of us by maybe 50,000 units. I mean, very small number. Hmm. And the Atari was much more integrated, had sprites. It was a better, it dealt with graphics better. It was a more flexible machine, but it didn't have as many expansion slots as the Apple II did. And but the biggest difference is I had left Atari at the time, and Atari went around saying that they were going to sue you if you wrote software for it, because they perceived it to be an IP battle. They had hired way too many attorneys, because they were, you know, in the record business, and that was their mindset. And where Apple was around evangelizing software development. And the difference was huge, because people don't buy hardware, they buy software.
Right.
And the hardware that's required to run it. And so Apple had VisiCalc first, it had a decent word processor first. And it was, you know, the policy was turned around 18 months later, but by then Apple had clearly taken the lead and had so much more stuff going for it that they basically dominated the school market and a lot of the other places. And the guys at Warner, who took over, really didn't understand the computer business at all. They were a bunch of Harvard MBAs and you know, entertainment idiots.
And we still have a lot of them around now.
Oh yeah, yeah. They were you know, it was really a company. Atari ran into trouble. I like to say Atari, you know, wasn't killed, it committed suicide.
And so you were you forced to, because you sold out and you made like $20 million, $28 million on it, right?
Yeah.
Was that a deal that you were forced to do? Would you have liked to have kept going with Atari?
You know, yes and no. I wanted to take some money off the table. And I was tired. You know, I'd been fighting cash flow for 6 years, because even though the company was growing, we never had cash. I mean, never. Because a growing company actually consumes a certain amount of cash. And even though profitability is, you know, we were profitable every year. But I think that if I'd just taken a 2-week vacation, I would have figured out a way to keep from having to sell.
So, and then a couple of years later, the company was worth like $2 billion.
Yeah.
It seems like you're the genius at spotting the early stuff and then maybe letting it go before it gets too big.
You know, I kind of am. I like the early phases better. Hmm. You know, once a company starts to get big, the CEO spends all their time with accountants and attorneys, and those guys are really boring.
Right. Well, I mean, anyway, you took $28 million. That's, you know, no small sum, especially in like 1980 or whatever it was.
Yeah, 76, actually.
Hmm. So you were basically set for life back then.
That's correct. I, you know, though, I actually made more money personally on Chuck E. Cheese.
Oh, really? So why don't you tell us how that story that happened? I mean, I since I grew up in Australia, I'm less familiar with it, but certainly I'm sure it's interesting to hear.
Well, that was really about Chuck E. Cheese was started inside Atari, and it was meant to allow the company to vertically integrate towards this market without really competing. The competition was for locations, and I felt if we built our own locations, that wouldn't damage our reputation with our customers who were buying our coin-operated games by the thousands.
Were you still connected with Atari at that point, or had you totally moved on?
I actually built the first one about 6 months prior to my sale to Warner. And so it actually went with the sale. But Warner, upon taking over, said, hey, we don't want this. Why don't you sell it off? And I said, hey, let me buy it. And they said, okay. And so I bought that outside of Atari and was growing it slowly while I was actually still working out my Atari contract.
So you had the idea for Chuck E. Cheese while you were at Atari. You built it out while you were doing Atari. So I guess this is like the entrepreneurial ADD that you saw the next thing. And so this is the direction that you went in. And then you sold Atari. You took Chuck E. Cheese back. And that was, it was a complementary thing that you went and then built out as a separate venture.
Exactly right.
And you had kids then, so I guess your daughter was starting to grow up, and this was, you know, is that sort of what inspired it?
It was partially, but it was also just the realization that kids wanted to play our games but didn't have a good venue to do so. You know, bars weren't good for them. Believe it or not, this was before pizza parlors had video games in them.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was before you had everything. I mean, this is... No, I get it. You know, this is the early days.
Yeah.
So, and then how did Chuck E. Cheese do? Like, how did that story... Did you scale that? Was that all from Northern California as well, from Silicon Valley?
Well, yeah. I opened up a shop basically down the street from Atari, literally down the street and around the corner, and started growing it and... franchising, and I took that public, did several, you know, capital raises to fund the growth, grew it to 250 stores, 250 units, and these were all big locations doing $1.5 million to $2 million a year. So it was a pretty substantial company when I sold it.
And so then what did you do after you sold Chuck E. Cheese?
I kind of started being a venture capitalist. I started this thing called Catalyst Technologies, which was the very first technical incubator. And we incubated these, you know, many of the 20 companies that we talked about, in which I wrote the business plan, put people around. And, you know, we did the first automobile navigation. We did the first online retail.
Did it affect your motivation, given that you'd cashed out pretty well on two companies already, or do you just wanted to keep starting stuff?
I liked the idea of starting stuff. I started doing some sailboat racing, and you know, I was... I always liked to travel a lot, and you know, my wife and I did a lot of charity work and things like that. But I don't think I wasn't quite as driven as when I was doing Atari and Chuck E. Cheese, but pretty driven.
And so after then. So you traveled a bit, you took some time out, you started a bunch of different companies, and maybe zoom forward to where you're doing today. You're working on a company around brain stuff and anti-aging.
That's correct. basically, I think that I can use some interesting technology that that I have discovered and literally teach kids 10 times faster in terms of certain subjects. And that's quite interesting to me, because I think that right now we have somewhat of a crisis in education. I think our kids are accustomed to a much higher level of interactivity and speed. I think that the classroom is boring to kids today. It was boring when I was growing up, but I think it's boring to everybody right now.
Oh, I loved every minute of classroom.
And I think that that what boring academic institutions do for you is, I think it destroys enthusiasm, which I think is maybe the worst amputation. Because I think almost everything good in the educational realm comes from enthusiasm.
And that intensity when you can really engage in something and do something that really fascinates you.
Exactly. I think I could rant and rave about how screwed up school is, not only in how they teach, but what they teach, you know, how you fix things, you know, the whole nine yards.
One of the things that some of the top entrepreneurs have for the last while, it's becoming almost a cliche, is they drop out of school. I didn't drop out of school, but I mean, I almost did. You got all the way through. Do you think some of these guys can't necessarily be taught in a school curriculum at all, unless they're following their own nose?
Well, you know, I don't think it's a matter of they can't, but I think it's unnecessary. I mean, my son right now, who just turned 19, has just got on an airplane this morning to service one of his customers. He started his company basically a year ago. He'll do over $1 million this year, and we had to fight to keep him in high school. He's been coding since he was like 11, and he's learning at a really remarkable rate. And you know, I just think that it's not, I'm not saying that hooray for my son, I'm saying it a pox on the school system that they've driven him out.
So is he still in the school system, or is he dropped out?
He's dropped out. I don't know if you saw the movie Van Wilder. He says, I'll go back to college when I can do it like Van Wilder.
I haven't seen that, but...
Well, it's sort of a coming age where this rich kid has one hell of a good life in a lavish apartment and raises a lot of hell in college. But he's definitely enabled in that by having a very rich father.
Right.
And of course, I tell all my kids that if they're planning to go to college with me supporting them, it's not going to be lavish.
Actually, I'm curious to hear a little bit about that from your perspective on wealth, and then through to the next generation. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have both talked about how they're not leaving big inheritances for their kids. How do you think you're going to do that with your family?
Oh, I'm going to leave them absolutely nothing. And I tell them that. I mean, I think that it would be just such a bad thing to do. I have seen so many worthless kids of Silicon Valley executives. And I think that one of the true gifts that you can give your kids is the ability to struggle and win. But if you give them, you know, teach them how to fish, don't give them a fish. And I call it getting my kids launched. And that means, how do you get them to where they have a happy and productive life based on what they've known or what they've earned themselves. I think you create dependency. I think you create unhappiness when you give kids too much money.
I think that striving is really important. I've read quite a bit about the Rockefeller family and how they evolved. And it doesn't seem like the wealth that was handled down through the family was necessarily always great for them.
I could tell, without naming names, I can tell you that the kids who are children of some of the very, very successful Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are a mess. They're an absolute mess. And my kids aren't.
So what will you do? What will you do with your money when you die?
Oh, I think I'm probably going to die before my wife, so it's going to be pretty much up to her.
I mean, these are big and serious questions, and I mean it's not a simple thing to handle.
Well, I think that I'm very passionate about education, doing it the right way. I think that there's some ways that we can pass the torch that is more interesting and more powerful than the way it's being done. I like entrepreneurship on a lot of scales. And that's probably good enough for me.
Before we move on, I just want to cover a little bit more on your current brain startup. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how it works?
Yeah, it's basically a business of we're creating learning engines, meaning that the brain science is encapsulated in how the information is presented. And so we are doing it much like Wikipedia, in which any teacher can put in a piece of curriculum. And these are called brain rushes, and they're 10 to 15 minutes in length for a kid to play, which is turns out to be another optimum time frame for holding and generating attention. And with that, we have a pretty robust system. And so what we want to do is crowdsource the curriculum, which means, when I say crowdsource, I really want to be able to have everybody, every teacher use it, put in the stuff, and then publish it to everybody, and it's free.
It's a free thing that you're going to distribute to schools?
Yeah, just go into brainrush.com. Distribute to anybody who wants to learn. And they're very simple games, but they actually have underneath the hood some really interesting brain science.
And this is from you as having founded Atari and Chuck E. Cheese, so I guess this is an area that you'd know a little bit about.
Yeah, and it turns out that some of the principles of learning are the same principles that were required to make a good video game. You climb into some of the same neural pathways. You get some of the same endorphin responses. I actually think we can make education as addictive as video games.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't see why not. And yeah, you'd be the right guy to do that, something like that, that's for sure.
Well, I think it'll make it real different. Unfortunately, I've got an 11 o'clock here that I'm going to have to pop off for.
Okay. Do we have 2 minutes to wrap up, or do you need to
Sure,
stop?
Let's just do a quick wrap up.
Okay. Well, just before we stop, there's one thing I would like to ask you is advice do you have for those of us in the startup internet era that we should think about from your era? or that you see that we should do this?
Well, I think that what I advise everybody to do is to do a lot of different things. You know, go to trade shows as often as you can. In fact, you know, just recently I've written a book, Finding the Next Steve Jobs. I don't know if you were aware of that, but it's really about how to deal with creative ideas, creative people, how to create, really, and that it's about action. And the book I'm working on right now that I hope to have published next year is how do you really create all the mental grist for creative ideas. And the core concept is to do a lot of different things, have a lot of different experiences. And through that process, there will be an idea that becomes compelling that you have to pursue, and that will be your business.
I feel like I could sit and talk with you for about 6 hours, but let's wrap up there. Thank you very much, Nolan.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you.